Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Years ago, this month, at a resort in New Hampshire's White Mountains, a new global financial system was born. It was called the Bretton Woods Agreement, named after the town that hosted the conference at the Mount Washington Hotel. More than 700 delegates from around the world attended, hoping to create new economic and financial structures that would help the world avoid another world war. Today in The Exchange, what Bretton Woods was all about and where the system it established stands today. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is Kirk Dorsey, history professor in the College of Liberal Arts at UNH. And Kirk, it's great to see you. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure.
So first question, before we get into all the structures and systems that were set up at Bretton Woods, why Bretton Woods, New Hampshire? Why not New York or D.C. or some other place like that?
Heat and humidity. So they didn't want to be in Washington, D.C. For a long time, British diplomats, in fact, got tropical hazard pay for serving in Washington, D.C.
Really?
Because summers were so miserable before the age of air conditioning. And even New York City was pretty hot in July of 44. So Franklin Roosevelt told them to go up somewhere in the northern New England region, Maine or New Hampshire, find a place. And the Bretton Woods Hotel was, the Mount Washington Hotel was in disrepair, but was repairable in time. So they sent an army of laborers who went and fixed up the hotel in time to get all the delegates in. And even then, they couldn't fit all the delegates. As you said, there were 700 plus press people. So mainly it was to get out of the heat and humidity of the East Coast.
Wow. Well, our producer, Jessica Hunt, put some great pictures on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You can see what it looked like. You can see the people. It's really cool. Just speaking about why Bretton Woods and, you know, what it was like for people there, here's a newsreel from that time. This is just describing the event as it began at the Mount Washington Hotel. Let's hear.
At Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, delegates from 44 allied and associate countries arrived for the opening of the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference. They will work in the seclusion of this White Mountains resort. Delegates to this monetary and financial conference pose on the hotel lawn. These meetings are designed to promote trade in the post-war world and to create a foundation for lasting peace.
Hope they created the foundations for lasting peace. So lofty goals there at Bretton Woods.
Absolutely. There was a widespread fear in the United States that when World War II ended, they'd have a repeat of what happened after World War I, which is an economic boom during the war and then a transition period. And the countries that had suffered the most in the war would start protecting themselves. And eventually you would get more trade wars like they had gotten in the 1930s. And so the hope was that if the countries cooperated, coming even before the war was over, they could set up an economic system that would allow them to avoid war in the future. So the widespread feeling around the world was that the war was about trade relations and people trying to take advantage of each other rather than trying to build up trading relationships that would cause peace.
Well, and I want to ask you about that, Kirk, because that's so important. And as you said, that's really what this was all about, recognizing the mistakes post-World War I, and hoping not to repeat those mistakes. But before that, I do have to note this conference took place in July of 44.
Yes.
So shortly after D-Day, but almost a year before World War II officially ended. So What was the thinking there?
Well, it's fair to say that for the U.S. government, it had been involved in post-war planning since August of 1941, months before the Pearl Harbor attack. FDR was pretty sure the United States was going to get in this war. In August of 41, FDR and Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister for Great Britain, announced the Atlantic Charter. One of the 8 points of the Atlantic Charter was after the final defeat of the Nazi tyranny. But the United States wasn't even at war with Germany yet, but they had already thinking about this. And the other points of the Atlantic Charter were, in effect, Woodrow Wilson's 14 points from 1918, that the international community would have to be set up on grounds of equality, that nations would have access to resources, even the vanquished nations would be protected in the post-war world. And I think one of the big things to keep in mind about this time period is that if you look at most Americans in, say, 1937, there was a poll taken in 37, and if my friend Andy Smith from the Polling Center were here, he'd say, oh, you know, those polls from the 30s were of marginal value, and he'd be right. But there was a poll in 1937 that suggested that two-thirds of Americans thought that the getting into World War I in 1917 had been a mistake. Two-thirds. And this is a war the United States won. So many people in the 1930s thought that getting into the war was a mistake. But by 1941, many more Americans had concluded the mistake had been 1919, the way the war was resolved, not the war itself. And so there was a sense that the war wasn't a mistake. It was Wilson's policies at the end of the war. And so now we had to rectify those. So that's why even before the war starts for the United States, Franklin Roosevelt is out there trying to sell American intervention after the war in organizations like the UN and then what would come out of Bretton Woods.
So what was the feeling or the consensus among leaders at that time, including these who gathered at Bretton Woods? What mistakes did they think had been made after World War I that probably helped feed World War II?
I think the biggest mistake was that the countries that left World War I had huge imbalances. One of the biggest events of World War I outside the battles was the shift in creditor and debtor status between Great Britain and the United States. So before the war, Great Britain was the greatest creditor nation in the world. It had the most owed to it. And the United States was the greatest debtor nation. It owed the most. But by the time the war was over, the U.S. had about a $7 billion swing in how much money was owed to it. So the U.S. exited the war in a much stronger position. But as we know, Americans left World War I with this attitude of ambivalence about the European allies, as shown in the rejection of the Treaty of Versailles and unwillingness to get in the League of Nations. So in many ways, what the British thought, the biggest mistake was that the United States didn't do its part after the war. And this was particularly true, for instance, in 1930-31 with passage of restrictive tariffs like the Hawley-Smoot tariff that closed off American markets just as the Great Depression was starting. So there was a widespread belief that there was a lot of dislocation caused by the war that was never really addressed. And so it was papered over in the 1920s. But when the first crisis came, and crises happen all the time, there was no institution in place. So the stock market crash of 1929 led to a domino theory, the real domino theory, not the one from the Eisenhower administration, but a real domino of series of collapses by national banks and national economies that then led to the desperation of people in Germany who turned to Adolf Hitler. So they saw it as sort of a logical progression. We wouldn't have had Hitler if we had had a better post-World War I solution.
Well, and in addition to the sort of instability or fragility of those financial structures that you talked about, there's another piece of this, Kirk, that I would love for you to talk about more. You said the idea coming out of Bretton Woods was the vanquished would be protected. That's a shift in thinking, isn't it?
Huge. In terms of world history, how often does that even happen, that the United States or any country that is anticipates victory is saying we are going to treat the vanquished peoples separate from their government. So the German people and the Japanese people will get rid of their governments, but those people will be, in effect, quickly rehabilitated and put back into the world system. And this was obviously a sore subject with, say, the Soviets, who did not think the Germans could be treated as, you know, people to be incorporated evenly. They wanted the Soviets punished. The French were not really crazy
about this.
You mean
the Germans punished?
Yeah, I'm sorry. They wanted the Germans punished. And the French wanted the Germans punished. And a lot of people in Britain felt the same way. So the idea that it wasn't the German people, it was the German government, and that we could get rid of the government and let the German people reintegrate themselves, that was really striking. And it's hard even today for countries to say, well, we'll get over the war and then we'll get back together and we'll like each other. But this is something pretty traditional in American foreign policy, where the U.S. government frames its problem with a particular government rather than those people under that government. And so we can work with those people once their bad government is taken off.
Well, it's almost biblical. You know, we will not take revenge. We will approach this with forgiveness and repair. And that was the approach, with the understanding or the feeling that the punishment on Germany after World War I, the reparations that people had to pay, led to severe economic hardship. And again, you know, leading into World War II.
Right. And there was a big split even in the United States about Germany. So the Treasury Secretary, who ultimately oversaw a lot of the American positions at Bretton Woods, was Henry Morgenthau. And he had what was known as the Morgenthau Plan, which was to divide Germany into a bunch of tiny little states that would be deindustrialized. And he had some support within the U.S. government and certainly within foreign governments. But at the end of the day, most American leaders believed that the only way to have a healthy European economy was to have a healthy Germany at its center. And a healthy European economy was good for a healthy United States. So even though there are many people who agreed with Morgenthau that the Germans deserved really severe punishment, more people in the U.S. government said, that's not going to solve our problems. That's just going to make Germany at some later date reorganize, reindustrialize, and we'll be fighting them again. So we have to treat the Germans as not the problem. We have to treat their government as a problem so we can fix Germany as a whole.
That's so interesting. Today, it's so hard to imagine because Germany is the industrial powerhouse of Europe. It's hard to imagine it broken up into little, you know, pastoral farmlands. But that was the image. You don't want to give them that economic might because they'll just remilitarize again.
And this was, and this was particularly true as they discovered more and more about the Holocaust. And it was easier to want to just completely punish the Germans. So it took a lot of willpower by the U.S. government to say there's a distinction between the German government and the German people, and we're gonna protect the German people and help them create new governments. And the same thing happens with Japan. I mean, they learn a lot about Japanese war crimes, particularly in China, but they still say we're going to punish the top level and then we're going to reintegrate Japan into the world system. And we can't have a system with Germany and Japan as permanent enemies. It just won't work.
Wow. And Chinese delegates were at the Bretton Woods conference.
Yes. And they, of course, were not happy about any of this idea about working with the Japanese. But at the same time, they understood their position, which is that the United States had all the resources. It was keeping Britain in the war, in many ways was keeping China in the war financially. So at a certain level, they understood they had to compromise with the United States.
Given how much the Chinese suffered, given how much the French and Soviets suffered, and the British too, those debates at Bretton Woods must have been ferocious.
Correct. You know, the Bretton Woods negotiations themselves were more about the allied states. And so they did not get directly into what would happen to Germany. But the United States had made the position before the war that Germany was going to be reintegrated. So I think at a certain point they agreed they were just not going to talk about Germany and Japan at Bretton Woods. But everybody understood the American position, or they understood at least several important Americans were prepared to reintegrate Germany. I think at a certain level, the American government was still sorting out its Germany policy in 1944. But there was widespread understanding, for instance, among the British and French, that if it were up to the United States, probably Germany would simply be reintegrated after the war once the Nazis were cleared out.
Again, today in The Exchange, we're looking back at the Bretton Woods Agreement. It set up a new world financial system 75 years ago this month, so July 1944, at a conference at the Mount Washington Hotel right here in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. Let's hear from you. What stories have you heard about this important global event? What questions do you have about the system that it set up? Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Kirk, we have a couple Facebook comments that I want to share with you in a moment. But one more question just about who was at this conference. 700 delegates, that's a lot of people. Where were they from besides obvious countries like US, Britain, France? You mentioned China, for example. Was the Soviet Union there?
Yes. And so this is one of the big surprises. In fact, really throughout the mid-1940s, the United States government spent an inordinate amount of time guessing what the Soviets were going to do and what they were thinking. So they weren't entirely sure whether the Soviets would send a delegation. And when the Soviets did decide to send a delegation, the Soviets then did what they normally do at these international meetings in the 1940s, which is state their position and then wait for everybody to come to their position. People at the conference complained that the Soviets would never cooperate with them. And I wrote a book on whaling in this time period, and it's the same thing at the whaling convention. The Soviets would say, this is what we want, and then they would just wait till people decided to give it to them. Because the idea of a post-war settlement that did not include the Soviet Union would raise the specter of yet another world war, but this time it would be with the Soviet Union. So if they could get the Soviets in the system, they thought there would be more hope for world peace after the war. As it turned out, the Soviets in 1945 decided not to join any of the Bretton Woods institutions because they said that they thought they were sort of Western capitalist traps for them. But at the meeting, the Soviets in the final decision agreed that they would participate at the level that the United States had originally proposed. So the Soviets turned out to be cooperative at the 1944 meeting at the final instance, but then later decided that they, for large strategic reasons, they weren't going to join the institutions.
Well, in a way, it kind of makes sense because they had their own communist system.
Yes.
And it did not mesh with capitalism.
It really didn't, because the whole idea of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank was that countries would put in a certain amount of money based on the size of their economies, but they would also have to have openness when they took money out of these banks or used the banks. So the very first loan that went out went to the French government, and under the Bretton Woods system, and the institution basically required the French government to kick the communists out of their government and to make sure that the World Bank got paid back first. So, you know, these institutions had a lot of power. If they were going to loan you money, they expected you to live up to certain terms. And the Soviets were never going to agree to that kind of control. It's similar to the Marshall Plan, where the U.S. actually issued an invitation to the Soviets to join the Marshall Plan in 1947-48. But part of the terms included that all the countries in the Marshall Plan would have delegates who could look at, in effect, the country's internal economic books. And the Soviets wouldn't have any of that. They couldn't have external auditors, in effect.
Well, that is a lot of power. So if France had wanted to get some of these loans to help rebuild the country, it had to kick communists out of its government?
Yeah, so...
Because they were a big part of the government. They were a major party. They were a big part of the resistance that helped defeat the Nazis.
They were really core to the resistance.
For that.
Exactly. So, well, but by 1947, you know, the focus had shifted from the Nazis to the communists. And so the communist threat now seemed to be very real. And so the French were told, if you want a loan, we can't have a risk that the communists would take over the French government. So show us your seriousness by removing the communists from the coalition.
And did they do it?
They did it. So they took the loan and removed the communists from power. And, you know, the U.S. worked very hard to keep communists out of Western European governments. One of the CIA's first acts was to influence the Italian elections in 1948 to defeat the Communist Party. So,
well, a couple comments on Facebook that I want to share with you. John from Wilmot noted on Facebook, another New Hampshire historical meeting with big implications. John says they also settled the Russo-Japanese War at Bretton Woods in 1906. Actually, I think, John, thank you for the note. I think it was Wentworth by the Sea in Portsmouth,
right? It was
right?
In Portsmouth, yes. Yeah, actually on the naval base, which is in Kittery or Portsmouth, depending on which state capital you're from.
Okay, but still, I appreciate the comment that he's absolutely right. There was another big treaty or agreement signed right here in New Hampshire with important global implications.
And for similar reasons, Washington was miserable. So let's go up north where it was more amenable to sitting around tables for hours at a time and negotiating, because that's what they did both at the Portsmouth negotiations at the end of the Russo-Japanese War and in this agreement. And, you know, these were eras before air conditioning. So your air conditioning was a sea breeze or a breeze off snow-capped Mount Washington. So they needed that kind of situation to keep the delegates focused.
Well, thank you for the comment, John. And again, we welcome your comments. exchange@nhpr.org is the email. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Another big concern that the delegates were focused on at this conference, Kirk, was currency manipulation and wild swings in global currencies. So why was that such a big problem?
So in 1930, when the U.S. government passed the Hawley-Smoot tariff, there's a famous chart by a historian named Kindley Berger, which looks like a spider's web. And it basically is charting the decline of global trade from the passage of the Hawley-Smoot tariff. And it's like a water going down a drain. It spirals around closer and closer to zero. Each month, there's a decline in global trade. And so when countries are not able to trade because there are increasing tariff barriers, then they often find themselves within imbalances in their currency, and so they devalue their currency. So if you happen to be holding British pounds and it gets devalued, your pounds are worth a lot less. So for a business purposes, you want stability in currency. And so this is one of the biggest things they wanted to set up, was stability.
Okay, and that gets a little complicated, but we will dive into that after a short break, how the Bretton Woods Agreement tried to address this, how that system stayed in place for a couple decades, but then it kind of crumbled and fell apart. We'll follow up on that after a short break, and we'll take more of your comments. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, 75 years ago, a new world financial system was created at a conference held at New Hampshire's Mount Washington Hotel. It was called the Bretton Woods Agreement, and this hour we're finding out what happened there and what remains of the Bretton Woods system today. Let's get your questions in. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. What questions do you have about the system that was set up at Bretton Woods? What is still existing with this system today? What stories have you heard about this important global event at that small town in northern New Hampshire? Again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Kirk Dorsey is here, history professor in the College of Liberal Arts at UNH. And Kirk, let's jump right into it. One of the huge implications and changes that came out of Bretton Woods was how currencies are, I don't want to say created, but how they interact with each other, how they are manipulated. So what was the problem there that Bretton Woods was trying to fix with currencies?
Yeah, so before the break, we were talking about the trade imbalance. And so countries, for the longest time, your currency was based on precious metals. You had a certain amount of gold and you could print currency, or you'd literally coin the gold and that would be your currency. So American dollars had been exchangeable for gold for most of American history until Franklin Roosevelt took the Americans off the gold standard at the start of his presidency.
So let me just stop you there, because that's pretty remarkable that we were on the gold standard up until the 1940s.
Yeah. Well, to the 30s, because it was in the Depression when countries then got off the gold standard.
I see.
And then started manipulating their currency to try to protect their exporters so that they could hopefully export goods to try to fight unemployment at home. And so the concern of the economists at this meeting, and it's important to remember economists are, you know, trying to sort out what the post-war economy was going to look like. So this is a big challenge they had, was that after the war, countries would naturally do what they had done before the war, which is manipulate their currencies to help their own citizens, even at the expense of other countries' citizens. And what you would get then is almost like an arms race. Everybody would be doing it, and it would hurt everybody.
It's a downward spiral.
It's a downward spiral. So the agreement that came out of Bretton Woods that was most central was that the U.S. dollar would be pegged $35 an ounce. And so you could get an ounce of gold for $35, and that would be a fixed exchange rate that the U.S. would have. And then every other currency among the allied states or any other countries who wanted to join in would be pegged to the dollar, so there'd be a fixed exchange rates. And the hope was that this would create stability so that international businessmen could know if they were making a 4 or 5 year investment that the pound and the dollar would be at a certain fixed exchange rate for all that time. Now, countries were still able to devalue their currencies from time to time, but rather than doing it almost constantly at war with one another, they had basically agreed to set up a system where they would all have a fairly stable exchange rate, which is remarkable to us now, because if you travel overseas, you're constantly checking the exchange rate. You know, is the dollar up, is the dollar down? But for most of the time after 1945 to the Nixon administration, it was a fixed exchange rate and you knew what you were getting.
Well, and businesses love stability. They want to be able to make long-term plans and know what the deal's going to be, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years out. So
yes, and so the other institutions out of Bretton Woods, one of which was the International Monetary Fund, was about protecting those exchange rates so that if a country was in a position where it felt for domestic political reasons it would have to devalue its currency, instead they could get support from the International Monetary Fund to protect their currency and stabilize their system so they wouldn't have to devalue, so they would not get into this downward spiral.
Again, getting back to our earlier theme, you know, the whole idea being global economic stability will lead to global political stability.
Absolutely.
So were we on the gold standard or not? It sounds like gold is still playing a role, but not as robust as before?
Right. So, I mean, in some ways it is robust because the U.S. economy is now back on a gold standard and everybody else's currency is pegged to the U.S. dollar. So effectively, the gold standard is how much gold is in Fort Knox. That's what's going to control currency around the world. And that was why Bretton Woods was a pretty big leap of faith by these allied nations, that they could trust the United States not to engage in, you know, what was called beggar thy neighbor policies, that the United States would take its economic supremacy and use it to try to uplift Western Europe in particular, as opposed to take advantage of Western Europe. But the Western Europeans had very little choice. They had so little reserves in 1944. I mean, the French government was not even in France. It was occupied. The Norwegian government was not in Norway. So these were occupied countries, in effect, trusting the United States to do the best it could.
Well, I want to play a little bit from John Maynard Keynes, again, the famed British economist. Here he is on a British newsreel, and he talks about the importance of reducing gold in determining currency values. When that happens, he says, a great weight has been relieved. Let's hear Keynes talking about his dislike of the gold standard.
There's no danger of the exchange falling too far. There's no danger of a serious rise in the cost of living. The worst I should expect would be a return to the prices of some 2 years ago. But meanwhile, British trade will have received an enormous stimulus, much more than most of us have yet realized. It's a wonderful thing for our businessmen and our manufacturers and our unemployed to taste hope again. But they must not allow anyone to put them back in the gold cage, where they have been pining their hearts out all these years.
That's so poetic, the gold cage where they've been pining their hearts out after all these years. What do you think about that clip that we heard from Keynes?
Well, partially gold is an easy thing to throw rocks at, right? We go back to American history, 1896. William Jennings Bryan, running on the Democratic ticket at the Democratic convention, said, "You shall not crucify mankind on a cross of gold," because the Democrats wanted coinage of silver, not just gold. And that speech was so popular, he went around for years afterwards giving the speech on the Chautauqua Circuit, because it was a great speech, and it framed to people this problem: I don't have any gold, so why is the gold standard good? So I think Keynes is trying to have it both ways. He's trying to tell the British citizens, you know, the gold standard was the old system, it didn't work, we got a depression because of that. But at the same time, Keynes knew as well as anybody that the currency system had been set up. He didn't choose it, but his assistants and his supporters in the British delegation supported it, that this currency exchange system based on an amount of gold in Fort Knox was the new law of the land after World War II. So he was trying to have it both ways there, I believe.
Well, he wanted to make one world currency called the Bancor.
The Bancor, yes.
Yeah, so how close did this come to reality?
About as close as the likelihood of a U.S. Senate vote in favor of the Bancor, which was none. So, and actually, this is one of the things that the U.S. delegation kept telling the British, but anybody who would listen, you can come up with all the wonderful ideas you want. We need to get 2/3 of the Senate to approve it. And that would usually stop the more utopian visions of somehow a global currency. But there were American negotiators, too, who thought, well, maybe this is a step to a global government. So we'll actually have a global economic system with more centralized government somewhere 40, 50 years down the line. But they could always count on senators, including Senator Toby from New Hampshire, but also Midwestern isolationists who were just not going to accept a global currency. There was no way the United States would ever have the Bancor as any official currency.
Wow. Well, that would be a good paper for an economics student. Bretton Woods had adopted the Bancor.
And a good paper for American historians, because the U.S. Senate has an incredible amount of power in foreign policy. And the British knew this because they had on several occasions negotiated treaties with U.S. diplomats only to watch the Senate, you know, start fiddling with it and move pieces around, or most clearly in the case of the Treaty of Versailles, just say, no, we don't want this, and reject it.
Wow,
so they knew that the Senate was not a bluff when U.S. diplomats said the Senate will never pass this.
Let's go back to our listeners, Kirk. Again, our number here in the exchange for you to join us with your comments about Bretton Woods or just your questions about what happened there 75 years ago, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Dave is calling from Henniker. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. My question for the professor is, too, does it seem to you that you really had a positive effect in substantial terms by that one agreement, meeting for agreement? Because it seems like so many of the things like tariffs and different countries manipulating their currency the way they want to for their own benefit is still going on. And if it hadn't been for continued concerns, continued meetings, continued focus on this over the years, the agreement by himself wouldn't have had much effect. And the second question is, I think the World Bank was also created, and I've heard that there's a lot of negative projects that were funded by that, negative in terms of the country's economy. And I wonder if that, in your point of view, has had a positive or a neutral or negative effect over time?
Great questions, Dave. Thank you so much. Let's take the second one first, because he's right. The IMF, which worked more on currency stability, was created at Bretton Woods, but so was the World Bank.
Yes, and the World Bank has had a lot of different lives. In the 50s and 60s, it was really a development bank for what we would have called then the third world or the developing world. And the idea was to build these big infrastructure projects that would help countries become more modern and more industrialized.
And dams and
Harbors.
Railway
and
systems.
Airports and things like that. And a lot of the countries were unable to pay these things back. And there has been a lot of criticism of the World Bank, not just on the grounds, actually very similar to what the Chinese are doing with the Belt and Road Initiative. They're loaning lots of money to people to build infrastructural projects that sometimes the countries can't really use. And then there's the question, well, who's going to pay these back? In the case of the World Bank, because it was an international institution, even with American power, this was not about manipulating Uruguay into doing something it didn't want. But it did cause these countries sometimes to take on debt that they couldn't pay back. And then related to that were the environmental challenges that a lot of these mega infrastructural projects like building dams on rivers had enormous environmental consequences that nobody was thinking about in the 1950s and 60s. So there was a pretty big transition in the World Bank. You know, the World Bank is like any global organization. It's got a mixed record. And, you know, I think most of the people working in the World Bank had their hearts in the right places. They were trying to alleviate poverty and create systems of trade that would help people around the world. But oftentimes these projects go wrong. Even what they thought they were getting at Bretton Woods wasn't entirely what they were getting. The world changes under your feet. And then the first question
was more about an observation, and it's a great one, Dave, that currency manipulation still goes on, trade wars still go on. So there's been sort of a constant vigilance toward these issues through institutions like the World Bank and the IMF and other newer institutions.
Right. So I think the biggest thing out of Bretton Woods is a spirit of cooperation that the countries on the Allied side, in effect, were saying, we really messed up in 1919 by not having enough cooperation. And so now we're going to try to mitigate that problem by talking through our problems. And even if the solutions we came up with in 1944 were imperfect, they were still built on the idea of cooperation and how do we work our way through these problems. You know, Britain was a country that was basically bankrupt. It was living on American loans. But the United States didn't tell John Maynard Keynes, tough, you're going to live up to our standards. They negotiated with Keynes and tried to work out a system that the British could willingly buy into. And in terms of the quotas going into the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, you know, the U.S. drafted a schedule of quotas, but then negotiated with the countries, you know, how much can you pay? How much do you want to pay? So the United States really made an effort at this meeting to lead cooperatively. And that's huge in terms of when new disputes arise. You know, the big dog, the United States, could have just said, tough, we're doing it our way. And it does from time to time in the post-war world, but more often than not, set the tone for cooperation. And, you know, one of the things that came out of the Bretton Woods meeting was a proposal for an international trade organization. It didn't get much support in the U.S. at the time, but the World Trade Organization that we have now, which is supposed to address the things that that Dave mentioned, are, in fact, the World Trade Organization is basically the International Trade Organization come to life. It took about 50 years, but it did come to life as a way of addressing these tariff barriers and trade wars and currency manipulation to try to set a level playing field. And again, it's got its flaws, but it's about an idea that if we trade with one another, we won't shoot with one another.
Yeah, and that's also the similar idea behind the European Union.
Right, and that's been huge progress. I mean, Bretton Woods is central force setting the ground rules that we can talk through our economic problems, and we may not all like the solutions, but we will at least try to solve our problems diplomatically rather than cutting off trade with one another, which then eventually leads to hard feelings and then leads to countries saying, well, if we can't trade for these goods, we're going to conquer them.
So fair enough to criticize the details and how these things worked. But you're saying, Kirk, let's praise and appreciate the spirit of cooperation, not competition, because that can lead to world war.
Absolutely. So, you know, I was thinking about the cemeteries in France. The U.S. has a couple of really major cemeteries in France. Almost all of your listeners know about the one at Normandy. They've probably seen it on TV, on Saving Private Ryan or someplace like that. Many have visited. There's a larger cemetery for World War I, the Meuse-Argonne Cemetery, that almost nobody goes to. But there are more Americans buried there. And those Americans were just as heroic as the ones at Normandy. In terms of military history, their contribution was just as important for shaping the outcome of the war. But for most Americans, World War I is that war that ended with a, you know, it just fell apart because the post-war settlement didn't work. So I think of that comparison of those cemeteries that people have forgotten the sacrifice that led to the Meuse-Argonne Cemetery, because when the war was over, the settlement was terrible. But the settlement of World War II worked. Obviously, it was flawed, but the Bretton Woods Agreement was really central to a post-war world that generally was peaceful, and countries that had been at war decided to solve their problems in other ways.
Well, and I love that it all kind of happened right here in New Hampshire.
Yes,
I
absolutely.
I think that's just great. So here's another comment from a listener. Stewart on Facebook says, the Bretton Woods Conference, quote, put the world into a huge mess, along with fractional reserve banking, a mess. Now, from what I understand, fractional reserve banking, that's where a fraction of bank deposits are backed by actual cash on hand and are available for withdrawal. Without getting into fractional reserve banking, because you're a history professor, not an economics professor, you know, I think there are others like Stewart who think, you know, Bretton Woods was a mess and these institutions it set up didn't work.
Sure. And it's impossible to know what would have happened coming out of World War II if we hadn't had Bretton Woods or Dumbarton Oaks setting up the UN. The other important piece of 1944 is the GI Bill to help. Again, these are all set up by American leaders who are worried about a return to the Great Depression. And they're trying to come up with a set of policies that will allow countries to cooperate rather than struggle with one another. So, I mean, he may be right in the sense that maybe without Bretton Woods, things would have been better. But the reality is, from 1945 to 1970, the world had pretty much unbroken economic growth. And the major powers stayed out of war with one another, which was good given the size of the armies and that there were nuclear weapons. So for those 25 years after World War II, the Bretton Woods system worked, I think, pretty well. There are a lot of criticisms of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. Certainly countries gave up their sovereignty. The banking rules changed. But at the same time, it's hard for me to imagine a system that would have worked better coming out of a global war than the system they came up with.
Real quick, you mentioned Dumbarton Oaks. Some listeners may remember that that's tied with Bretton Woods. It all kind of happened around the same time,
yes,
the summer of 1944. But just to remind us real quick where Dumbarton Oaks is and what happened there.
So it's a big estate in Washington, D.C., and the United States wanted to host meetings in the fall of 1944 among the major powers to set up rules for the new United Nations. So first, the Americans, British, and Soviets met, and then the Soviets left and the Chinese came in because the Soviets and Chinese could not talk to each other because the Soviets were not fighting the Japanese. So they were actually not allies in 1944. So at places like Dumbarton Oaks and the Tehran Conference, the Chinese and Soviets would not be in the same room.
So you had to have two separate meetings?
Separate meetings. So, but it's still, the idea was, let's set up the framework for what a new League of Nations, only we'll call it the United Nations, will look like in terms of who will have the power in this organization? What countries will have voting rights? Will the Soviets have one vote or a whole bunch of votes? Would the British Empire have one vote or a whole bunch of votes? And then in particular, would there be a Security Council? Who would be on it? Would certain states have vetoes? So Dumbarton Oaks in the late summer and early fall of 1944 was central for having the great powers work out what the UN would look like after World War II. And again, this is part of post-war planning before the war is over.
Right. That's what's so remarkable about it.
Whereas Woodrow Wilson waited till the war was over and then tried to negotiate it all at Paris and failed.
Well, coming up, we will talk about when the Bretton Woods system started to break down in the 1970s, why, but also, and you alluded to this earlier, Kirk, what replaced it, what remains. So we'll talk about that after a short break. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
NHPR's Summer Car Raffle is back. This year is bigger and better than ever because we're choosing three early bird winners to drive away with $2,000 in gas gift cards, good for any station of your choice.
Get your motor running.
You'll also be entered to win the grand prize, $25,000 toward a new car. So, if you're looking for adventure, get your raffle tickets now. One for $50 or six tickets for just $150 at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, National Public Radio's public editor takes your questions, so send them in by email before the show to exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. This hour, the 75th anniversary of the Bretton Woods Agreement. As World War II was winding down, this agreement set up a new international financial system in the hopes of avoiding another world war. We're finding out more about what happened, and we've been hearing from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Kirk Dorsey is here, history professor in the College of Liberal Arts at UNH. And Kirk, let's talk about when things started to unravel in the 1970s. You often see summaries that that's when Bretton Woods ended. I'm sure you dispute that a little bit. But what was happening in the late 60s, early 70s, where a lot of people started to say, ooh, this Bretton Woods system just isn't working?
Well, the biggest problem in the United States was that pegging gold to $35 an ounce was deflationary. So as the economy grew and as inflation set in, if you were still holding gold at $35 an ounce from 1945, it should be worth a lot more by the 1960s, and particularly when the United States was spending a lot under Lyndon Johnson, first of all in the Vietnam War, but also his social programs. You know, if you go through the Johnson papers, it's remarkable. You know, we're authorizing $200 million for a desalination plant in Israel and $200 million for this and that. I mean, Johnson, his budget guy must have had a huge ulcer. But so the U.S. the government was spending a lot of money, and the gold standard was keeping the American currency in check. So there was a great deal of inflation in the United States, and it simply wasn't accurate to say that gold was worth $35 an ounce anymore, or that the dollar could be converted. So Nixon had to make a decision whether to stick to that, to come up with a new value, as some of his advisors suggested, doubling it to $70 an ounce, or to just say, okay, the financial system of Bretton Woods has done its work. We've had 25 years of prosperity. Now it's time to go back to the old ways, where currency is easily exchanged, but it also is flexible, and it depends on the health of a world economy. So in 1971, he announced that the United States government was going off the gold standard. There would no longer be $35 an ounce exchange rate, that the United States was not going to keep sending gold out of Fort Knox, because that's what it was doing, because people were the United States had to send gold overseas. It was becoming, I should step back, for the first time since the late 1800s, the United States was actually running a trade deficit. It had been running a trade surplus almost constantly since the 1890s. And now, around 1970, it starts running a trade deficit, and it's only going to get worse. They can see the U.S. is importing an enormous amount of oil, for instance. So Nixon simply made the decision that the Keynesian system was no longer working. It's funny, because when he was elected, he said, we're all Keynesians now. And then one of the first things he did was get out of the Bretton Woods currency exchange, which Keynes had
so much
negotiated.
For that.
Yes.
Well, let's hear a little bit from President Nixon. This is August 15th, 1971. This is a big, big speech that he made announcing dramatic changes in economic policy, as you said, Kirk, including some of the structures of the Bretton Woods International Monetary System. And Nixon says in this speech he's doing it to protect the dollar from currency speculators.
Accordingly, I have directed the Secretary of the Treasury to take the action necessary to defend the dollar against the speculators. I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets. The United States has always been and will continue to be a forward-looking and trustworthy trading partner. In full cooperation with the International Monetary Fund and those who trade with us, we will press for the necessary reforms to set up an urgently needed new international monetary system.
Okay, so again, that's Richard Nixon saying in 1971, a lot of what was set up at the Bretton Woods agreement is no longer. See, he says that, don't worry, though, international partners, we're going to set up a new monetary system. Did they do so?
Not really. It became just open exchange, so that people— the funny thing is, if you're a currency speculator, this was a lot better for you, because as we've seen since 1971, currency speculators have started following almost every currency in the world to look for potentially overvalued currencies or undervalued currencies that they could make money trading, whether it's shorting it or buying it when it's cheap. Nixon was particularly concerned that $35 in 1971 was worth a lot less than it had been in 1945. So speculators could just buy gold, literally buy gold for $35 an ounce, and then expect that it would get more and more valuable. So he had to get off that system. And since then, they basically have just decided that we're going to trust that the dollar is worth something based on the American economy. And it's still, most global currencies are pegged to the dollar informally, if not formally. Most people think about, well, how does this compare to a dollar? Even the euro, in many ways, is pegged to the dollar that way. But that's the one currency that maybe has some independence from the U.S. dollar.
So this newer system, even though Nixon said he was doing it to protect the U.S. dollar from currency speculators, actually made life easier for currency speculators.
Yeah, so I think it did both. I think it protected the dollar because it freed up the dollar to be a representative of the strength of the U.S. economy. And so they, in effect, what they came up with was thinking about the money supply, and you could control the amount of money in the economy. You could control interest rates. So we're seeing that in the news. You know, the Fed sets interest rates. They basically decided that there were other ways to control the value of the dollar short of a very fixed gold standard. And, you know, it's generally worked. Obviously, there have been crises. 2008, they didn't get it right. And there was a case in the 1990s, for instance, when Thailand's currency got destroyed by international speculators. So the idea is the International Monetary Fund should be able to help countries like that by shoring up their currencies. But it's almost impossible to do.
You know, that's interesting because recently, I don't remember any sort of major currency crises. But you're right. Listening to you talk, Kirk, we have had these in, I don't know, the past decade or two. I remember a big one, I think, in Asia. And so we haven't seen, you know, crazy, crazy amounts of crises. Nixon says, you know, there was one every week for the past seven or one every year for the past 7 years. But we have seen some of these, but not as much as maybe you might think.
Right. And I think it's partially because the central bankers in countries around the world have had to figure out how to make the system work. And so if you have a false value to your currency, you either have to stop your currency from being traded on the international market, and some countries have done that. You can't trade North Korean, I'm not even sure what their North Korean currency is, but you can't trade that. You can't trade Cuban currency on the international market. So there are certain closed economies where their currency is not freely convertible. But if you're currency is freely convertible, anybody out there can go and buy it. So you have to actually engage in policies that make your currency worth what you say it's worth. And if you say it's worth something, but speculators can look at your bottom line and say, there's no way it's worth it, you'll get punished. So I think what's happened is that central bankers have had to learn the hard way not to participate in fraudulent schemes, that eventually they will be caught out and their currencies will be ruined and then they'll be in trouble.
So you have to keep your books in reasonable order so that your currency doesn't get devalued. It almost makes you do what you should do anyway.
I think so. I mean, in a weird way, it's globalization, which, again, Bretton Woods is part of, right? Bretton Woods is part of making sure that countries around the world don't think they can close themselves off and be prosperous. They have to engage in the global system. And if they engage in the global system, they'll be happier trading with one another than they'll ever be shooting at one another. And then the whole technology of globalization, which is separate from the policy, allows traders in New York to know what's going on with Cambodian currency or Thai currency or Indian currency and say, wow, we could make a lot of money if we buy Thai currency because in 6 months it's going down or it's going up. And, you know, so they have that kind of information. So I don't think governments can now successfully and continually protect their currencies in a way if they're freely convertible. So a country like China can get away with it, but most countries can't.
Is anybody calling for the gold standard today, Kirk?
Oh, from time to time, a politician will do it, but it's they're usually dismissed as cranks because you know, it's so old-fashioned and people don't put value in gold quite the same way. Plus, if you watch the gold market, you know, one day it's up to $1,200 and then a couple weeks later it's down to $900 an ounce. Gold is fluctuates quite a bit in how people value it. So I think there is marginal support for the gold standard, but it's not coming back anytime soon.
So if the IMF's role, as created by Bretton Woods, was to keep currencies from going wild and thereby destabilizing economies and governments, and then we went off the gold standard. So what does the IMF do now?
Well, it's in, if anything, it's more important because the IMF, I think, helps countries see where these potential discrepancies are arising and encourages countries to avoid them. But also, if they get themselves in a tight spot, they can turn to the IMF to help.
For loans?
For loans, mainly for loans. Yeah, for currency stabilization loans to sort of tide governments over. You know, currency devalues when governments are spending more than they have access to. And so they start printing more currency. And so the IMF comes in. It's usually not very popular. In recent years, think about what happened in Greece. You know, the whole idea, obviously Greece is in the Eurozone, so it can't quite have the same national discipline as a country outside the Eurozone. But to come in and say to Greece, you know, you can't continue to spend all this money that you don't have by borrowing from the Europeans. We're going to have to set you on a course of economic austerity, which is never popular. But the alternative is bankruptcy or getting out of the euro and trying to make it on your own. So usually austerity is bad, but all the solutions other than austerity are worse. And so the IMF is in many ways almost like an international consultant to help countries try to avoid getting into those situations.
So it makes loans for currency stability, and it kind of heavily suggests that currencies get their books in
order.
Yeah,
I think that's a good way to put it. So the IMF is truly international. I think the president is French, and they work hard to try to keep stability in the economic system. Again, on the theory that stability in the long run is better for everybody.
And the World Bank today kind of does the same thing, Kirk, but I feel like it's sort of changed its focus from these mega projects that please,
yes,
you know, powerful leaders in developing nations, and has focused more on the micro loans, the sort of direct to people loans.
And paying more attention at least to the idea of sustainability, if we can figure out what that means, that that these mega projects aren't really sustainable in many countries. So what would be sustainable? So both the World Bank and the IMF are with us. The World Trade Organization is very powerful, and it's a product of Bretton Woods. First, it was the proposal for the ITO, and then General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which came out of Bretton Woods, that eventually morphed into the World Trade Organization. So Bretton Woods is still with us and still influencing our economic decisions, and with the same goal of 1944, which is to try to smooth out the bumps and prevent a country from collapsing and then potentially turning to desperate measures.
How do you approach this topic with your students?
Well, most of the students are not aware of the Bretton Woods meeting. They are aware of the creation of the UN, and certainly they've heard of the GI Bill. So I, first of all, just try to start with the basics, that this is about the U.S. government and to a large extent, U.S. citizens making a decision that the mistakes have been made in 1919 and not 1917. So what are the solutions to those mistakes? So I just try to lay out the framework for why a World Bank or an IMF would be important. And then also, why would other countries want to join an American-led institution? What does this tell us about their power, but also their need to trust the United States? Because there is an enormous amount of trust behind these organizations, particularly not so much the UN, because the UN is more of a political organization, but for the financial organizations, the US put in the plurality of the money for the World Bank and the IMF. Both of them were set up in the United States with American leadership.
Yeah, and they're in DC today.
They're in DC. And so, you know, these countries just sort of had to trust that the United States was going to lead an international system that was not just about the United States. And I put it in a larger framework. You know, one of the things I emphasize for the students is that it's remarkable in U.S. foreign policy how often American leaders come back to this idea of universal human values, that there are values that people around the world share. The United States stands for those. They're in the Declaration of Independence. And its foreign policy, imperfect as it is, frequently comes back to these ideas of, well, what can we do to promote universal values? And even Barack Obama, as he was leaving office, he gave that interview in The Atlantic, I think with Jeffrey Goldberg. And I was just stunned. There in the middle, he's talking about the United States has stood for universal values. And, you know, this is something, even as he's leaving office, this is something we need to be continue to do. And so even Barack Obama, who was elected in 2008 at a time when it didn't look like the U.S. had a lot of universal values, or not around the world, it didn't appear that way, came back to this idea that this is what the United States, in its best, keeps fighting for. And so countries around the world can see the United States as representing world interests and not just U.S. interests. And at least as an idea, it's something worth striving for.
Well, it's interesting, too, that they've heard of the United Nations,
yes,
but they have not heard of the IMF or the World Bank.
I think they know about many of them know about the World Bank or IMF, but couldn't tell you where it came from,
uh-huh,
or that these were World War II institutions about bringing peace and stability. So if they've heard about the World Bank, it's, I'd say more often than not, the environmental critique of the World Bank and these huge mega projects and their problems. The IMF, they might have heard of, you know, in an Econ 401, 402 kind of class. But the origins of them and the centrality to making something good out of World War II is usually quite surprising to them.
When you present it for the first time, and you've kind of alluded to this already, Kirk, what strikes your students as interesting or unusual?
I think they find it remarkable, usually because they've just read about the isolationist period in the mid-1930s, that so quickly after that, the U.S. government has turned around and has shed almost all of its isolationism and has become the leader, even on economic grounds. It is a pretty remarkable transition in popular support. You know, when the Bretton Woods agreements go to Congress, Congress votes overwhelmingly for them. Even people who had been strong isolationists in the 30s vote for them. So I think they're shocked by how quickly the American attitude towards these institutions shifts. And then I think the other thing that's surprising is, because we know what happens next, is that 1944, they're working so hard to get the Soviets on board, and they really do see the Soviets as people they can hopefully work with in setting up this new world order. I think that there are a lot of realists in the U.S. government who recognize, even in the summer of 1944, that when the war is over, there's going to be a breakdown with the Soviet Union, and who don't put a lot of faith in Soviet promises. Mark Stoller, who was at the University of Vermont for many years, wrote this great book called Allies and Adversaries about how the U.S. Military High Command, as early as 1942, is planning for a post-war dispute with the Soviet Union. And when they're advocating landing in France in 1942, it's because they want to get into France before the Soviets overrun from the other direction.
Sure, because they don't want communists to take over
France. Exactly.
There's that fear again.
Exactly. They don't see Stalin as any better just because it's 1944. He's still the guy they didn't like in 1937. So there are a lot of realists in the American government, but there are other people saying, we have no choice but to work with the Soviets. Let's see if we can come up with a system that we can both make work.
And I've always been struck by the fact that all this was going on, you addressed this earlier, but all this was going on while there was still lots and lots of fighting left to go.
I mean,
July of 44, the war is not over yet. D-Day has happened, but the war is far from over.
And the war in the Pacific is really far from over. You know, in the summer of 45, they're anticipating months of fighting in Japan to end the war before they know the atom bomb will work and that the Japanese will change their policies in the aftermath of the bomb and the Soviet declaration of war. They're anticipating the war in the Pacific going on at least until December of 1945, but not into 46. So, you know, they're not saying, oh, this war is almost over. They're thinking, how close are we? Year, 2 years, maybe more. So it's pretty far-sighted.
Well, this is a big 75th anniversary period that we're heading into. We just had D-Day. Now we've got Bretton Woods. There'll be a lot of 75th anniversaries over the next year, Kirk. So I think we'll be seeing you again.
It'll be my pleasure.
We really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Kirk Dorsey, history professor in the College of Liberal Arts at UNH. Once again, a reminder that NPR's public editor will join us tomorrow. It's her job to hear from listeners. Comments, concerns, praise, and criticisms, send them in to exchange@nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.